in the last 20 plus years, I think the value of credibility was kind of the main currency that church leaders wanted to have. They wanted a seat at the table. They wanted to be credible to the audience. And so credibility became really the main currency. That meant that they were the temptation was going to be to get steered by your reputation. I think now, as we enter this more hostile environment, courage is going to be the fundamental leadership virtue. It's the leaders who are able to resist the mob, the reactive passions of their own people, of their own hearts, and of the world around them. Those kind of leaders will be incredibly attractive to Christians who are looking for any place to be faithful and to testify to the gospel.
Welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast, a podcast for Christians spooked by the growing hostility in the culture today. We will tackle a range of topics, from current events, persecution, missions, and what it means to be the church. You will gain valuable insights from those experienced working with persecuted Christians around the world, insights we all need to chew on in these strange days. Together, may we help the church stand. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast. I'm Andy, your host, and today we are joined by Dr. Joe Rigney. If you're not already familiar with him, he serves as a fellow of theology at New St. Andrews College. He's the author of 6 books. He's been busy. Previously, Dr. Rigney served as a professor and president of Bethlehem College and Seminary in Minneapolis, a pastor of City's Church in St. Paul, and a teacher at Desiring God. He's a dad. He's a husband. He has been taking a look at some issues that I think are very relevant to Christians today, and we're grateful to be joined by him. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I am excited to delve into some of the topics you've been exploring recently. You've talked about emotional sabotage, and in fact, you have a book that I believe published just a few weeks ago about this topic, and it's a mouthful between the title and the subtitle. The full thing is Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, Resisting the Anxiety That Will Wreck Your Family, Destroy Your Church, and Ruin the World. That's a tall order. What prompted you to jump on that project?
Yeah, so for about a decade or more, I've been influenced by a book called Failure of Nerve by a guy named Edwin Friedman, who was a rabbi writing in the 90s, family systems counselor and therapist and so forth. It's not a Christian, but wrote a really great book on leadership that I've used for years. It's kind of enjoyed a renaissance recently among Christians because it sort of puts its finger on some common social problems that work all the way from the home to the church to the civic sphere and so forth. But one of the challenges of Friedman's book was he's not a Christian. He's got a lot of evolutionary assumptions and thinking that kind of are woven all throughout his project. Even when he would put his finger on something real, his categories for addressing it were somewhat limited. I've, you know, over the years kind of been translating, you know, hey, he does some really great stuff, identify some really, even some solutions, but they need to be grounded better. And so this book was sort of my attempt to take the best of those insights, ground them in more biblical soil for the benefit of the church. And really kind of the impetus is that we live in this kind of age of anxiety and agitation and angst and turmoil, where everybody has this sense of the crackle in the air. And that crackle could be in your home. That crackle could be in your church. We see it out in the wider culture. And there's a sense of at any moment it could just blow up because social stampedes, people just kind of herding together and running from one thing to the next in a kind of reactive passion. Moment. And so that's kind of the problem out there and the problem that we feel in our own homes, maybe. And so what kind of leaders do you need in that sort of environment? Because Friedman's argument, which I think is true, is that the failure, kind of a failure of nerve, a failure of leadership, is both cause and effect of that increasing anxiety. So leaders ought to be the ones who are helping their communities navigate these things, endure these things. And so when leaders abdicate, you get more anxiety, and then the more anxiety makes it harder for leaders to function. And it's sort of this vicious cycle. And so to really encourage, godly, stable, steadfast, sober-minded leadership was really the heart of what I was trying to do in the book.
I think it's a timely effort, and it's a very short, digestible book. So that's wonderful. That's right up our alley, because we're trying to provide vitamins and nuggets for the church to grab onto and just benefit from quickly. And that's what this book does. I like your term crackle. There's definitely a crackle, a charged atmosphere that we're around. Everybody feels it. Everybody's head is nodding when that description is used. And I would even say that that crackle is not just in homes and churches and in our culture in the United States, but it's global. Working with Christians in different cultural contexts, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, there's weird things afoot. And there is a desperate need for stability and steady hands on the wheel. And I believe this book really works on that. How do you see this? Because if this has been a project of yours, or at least been percolating for a decade, it's 2024, and that sure looks a lot different than 2014. How has this ramped up in your view, and how is it perhaps arguably even more applicable today than it was just a few years ago?
Yeah, that's what's kind of amazing is that, A, Friedman was writing in the 90s, and yet and was putting his finger on these things. And then all of a sudden you're 20 years later and you're going, wow, it's still there. And 30 years later, how much more so? I think that, social media sort of amplifies these tendencies. It kind of binds us all together, but not always in a healthy way. So that, the global world, bound together by our technologies means that all of those pathologies, all of the reactive, all the passions can just sort of run through a system really fast. And every time when they're running through, they're building steam and building strength as we ping off of each other. And so it's sort of like the more emotional dominoes that fall, the greater the kaboom. And so so I think that the social media, the rise of social media in the last decade has really amplified. But I think part of our challenge is we think that the social media caused it, when really it just took features, universal features of human relationship and society, and really blew them up, right? Mm-hmm. So it augmented and magnified these tendencies, but they were already there. And so part of the task is to see the family resemblance between, say, the crackle in your home and the tensions and frustrations that may show up there, and then the kind of that wider cultural version of it. So when you can start to see, like, hey, the same tendencies, the same reactivity, the same emotional dominoes are present in all of these different places. Okay, if the problem is roughly the same in each of the different places, would the solution be the same as well? And that's what Friedman was commending. I think that the Bible commends a similar vision, which is why, trying to ground it more in the scriptures was such a big part of this project. But to really see, like, yeah, there is a common problem, and God has provided a solution at every level.
Yeah. And I think that's an accurate assessment. This is all the human heart has always been in play. We've always been fallen. We've always been doing these types of things as a race. But yeah, in the last 10 years, you have algorithms at play that are designed to amplify these feelings, this frustration, this chaos. It actually rewards it, it seems. The more it stirs up the pot, the more play it gets. So yeah, it's almost like we have a more high potency version of this playing out in 2024. With big elections coming on, with huge social dynamics at play in different countries, massive problems. So yeah, you really have this crescendoing, and I think this book is well timed to be able to speak to it. Would you relate to us a little bit about how this sense of sabotage, emotional sabotage, what does that look like, and how is it being deployed?
Yeah, so one of the key kind of arguments of the book is that we sometimes think if you start being a faithful leader, if the virtue that I'm commending is sort of an organizing virtue in the book is sober-mindedness, which is one of those words. It's in the Bible. It's not limited to the Bible. The ancient philosophical tradition encouraged sober-mindedness, but it's a core virtue for leaders in the scriptures, for pastors in the church and deacons and things like that. And I think some people have a sense that if I start being a leader, a faithful, godly, steady, sober-minded leader, then everything ought to go well. When in actuality, if you're in this kind of anxious, angsty system, faithful leadership is going to result in sabotage, because all the passions that have been running the show for so long will sort of revolt when you stop being manipulated. And so the forms of the emotional sabotage kind of refers to a couple. There's a number of different ways it could show up. The two that I really key in on in the book is the way that kind of slander, accusations, and blame can function as steering wheels. So most people want to be liked, want to be well thought of. The Bible commends us, you know, you want people, leaders who are well thought of by outsiders. But that also then creates certain temptation where your reputation becomes the be all end all. You need to be credible. You need to make sure your reputation is squeaky clean, which when the world discovers that you care about that, then they discover a steering wheel real fast, because all they need to do is threaten you, you know, start calling you names, and they just start, you know, figure out which name this person will respond to, and then use that as a steering wheel to get them to be quiet, to get off mission, to derail them. And so that's one form, really common form that it takes. And so there's the direct version of that, which would be the world calls you stuff and then you jump. The more subtle form is actually that the world will use the names to steer you by your soft-hearted Christian friends. So it's often that sometimes it's the case that you don't care what they're calling you, because you know that they call Jesus names. Jesus told us, you know, blessed are you when people say all kinds of falsehood about you. They did that to the prophets. They did it to Christ. They're going to do it to you. And so you've internalized that this is the worldly tactic, is the accusation, the slander. But sometimes your soft-hearted friends are more sensitive to that reputational steering wheel. And so they may say, yeah, we know it's not true, but you just, you know, you're saying things that are controversial. You're poking the bear. And so don't be surprised when the bear bites back. And there's sort of the, and so the harder thing to resist is not the direct attack, but the way that direct attack is sort of laundered into your community by soft-hearted Christians who then want to steer you, and they're reasonable. They're saying, yeah, we know it's false, or we know it's not all true. But don't you think you could just calm down for a bit, or don't you think you could just back off? And it's that actually that's the hardest to resist. That's the sabotage that is more easily takes Christian institutions and takes them off mission as they seek to try to placate and coddle and manage the image in all of these different spheres, rather than seeking to be faithful to the mission that God has given them.
I think that's why this is an important topic for us to be thinking about. Not only does it help us to make sense of the air we're breathing, the environments we find ourselves in, but I also think by identifying this and starting to see more clearly, we might be able to chart a course through all of this and understand what's going on. It is very easy to weaponize things that we care about, like our reputations. Maybe it's our opportunity to have influence, or just the perception of ministry, or who we're partnering with. I've seen all of these things come to bear, and just these subtle conversations, which is really how the enemy prefers to work. It's not a full frontal assault. It's that indirect, very surreptitious insinuation, something of that nature, that seems to register and hit home more often than not. Do you see this being recognized more in culture or in churches? Are people starting to wake up to it, and how are they starting to respond?
I do think that there's a growing recognition that the attempt to steer by insulting or slanderous accusations is ceasing to be as effective as it was. I think there was a time, you know, 5+ years ago, where it was a very effective tactic. So if you could, they may discover other labels that all of a sudden start to work. But for a long time, if, you know, the threat of calling someone a racist or a misogynist or whatever, and those terms were often simply the negative term applied to you believe in biblical manhood and womanhood, and oh, you must hate women and you're an abuser, and so those labels were effectively used to derail various institutions. I think that at least among certain circles, there's a recognition of the tactic, and therefore, okay, well, what do we need to do to resist it? How do we not spend all of our time trying to put out these fires that other people are starting? To try to, you know, they start a fire and then say, look, there's fire. And you're like, or they have a smoke machine and they say, look, there's smoke. There must be a fire. No, you just got a smoke machine. So I think there is a recognition. I think that one of the more effective, you mentioned it, is the kind of guilt by association tactic, mm-hmm. That is a steering wheel where, we see this a lot right now where you take the most extreme, sometimes a really, one that's actually bad, example of someone who holds your position, and they'll try to make that person the representative and then tie you to that extremity in order to steer you. And you'll, and so then you spend all your time trying to differentiate yourself from that group of people, rather than saying, you know what, I'm not worried as much about who they're going to, who the liars are going to associate me with. I'm going to just stay on message. I'm going to keep doing what we're doing. I'm not going to be derailed by it. Or other times is if they can take a faithful Christian ministry and make it toxic, controversial, then other Christians will sidle away from it in order to preserve their testimony. I don't know what's going on there, but I won't be near that Christian. And sometimes what's needed there is simply like put your arm around a fellow brother and go, you know, we may not agree on everything, but we're both Christians. And you see that sort of thing in the scriptures, that attempt to steer Christians by threats, by guilt by association. The one of the examples I use in the book is the situation at Antioch, where Peter, who was eating with the Gentiles for a while, gets a message from the Jerusalem church. We don't know exactly what the message was, but we can sort of fill in some gaps. You know, they're being persecuted. There's outside Jewish groups that don't like this new Gentile thing that's going on. And so you can imagine a message that's like, hey, Peter, you know, it's really tough for us every time people hear that you're eating with the Gentiles. Maybe you could just back off for a time. Mm-hmm. And it would be really subtle like that. It wouldn't be, hey, the Gentiles are wrong. That wouldn't have worked. The direct attack wouldn't have worked because Peter's the one who saw the vision, right? God gave him an explicit vision about fellowship with the Gentiles, with Cornelius. And so the direct isn't going to work, but a kind of plea based on compassion and empathy for suffering saints in Jerusalem might make him withdraw. And that's how Paul describes it. He drew back fearing the circumcision group. He was fearing these non-Christians who were attacking the church, and he draws back and then falls into hypocrisy. And then as a leader, this is the thing, right? That kind of cowardice was contagious. The rest of the Jews followed him, even Barnabas, the son of encouragement. He falls into this hypocrisy, and they withdraw and they won't associate with Gentiles anymore. So if you take that sort of scenario and you just ask yourself, which Christians am I tempted to put distance? You know, who am I reluctant to be seen next to because of the worldly pressure? You'll all of a sudden realize, oh man, I think I may do this more than I'd like to admit.
That'll happen in church contexts, schooling contexts, all types of different environments. You're spot on with it can become contagious when leaders start to fall for this. Everybody in the pews then is either confused or going to follow suit, and it can have these cascading effects.
We will return to the podcast momentarily, but first, a word from our sponsor. Being a Christian today can be hard. This is true if you live in a heavily persecuted country like Iran, or areas where cultural pressures against Christians are growing fast, like America and Europe. Fortunately, none of us have to stand alone. We are part of a giant body, one huge spiritual family that spans the globe. That is the church. The Christian Emergency Alliance is committed to helping the church stand, regardless of the pressures to come. As a 501c3 nonprofit, the Christian Emergency Alliance strives to help our spiritual family when persecution hits. We also strengthen the church by supporting ministry that makes Christ famous, defends biblical truth, and prepares fellow believers for challenges ahead. You have the opportunity to make a huge impact in this work today. Become a monthly financial ally of the Christian Emergency Alliance by signing up at christianemergency.com. Your support of $25 a month or a gift in any amount will bless those who need help in these darkening days. Help the church stand today, tomorrow, and in the days to come. Register today at www.christianemergency.com. And now, back to the show.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on some of the comments you made. I do think that in many Christian circles, the name-calling game is losing its effect. We've had name-calling inflation. It's been used so much that people recognize it just for absurd lies. It really doesn't stick anymore. So, yeah, I see that going away. But there's certainly efforts to discover new names, new slanders, new ways to mark people to be avoided. Like you mentioned, too, sometimes people be like, well, there's a fire. Well, sometimes they're the ones that said it, like you said. And they're also going to say, oh, and we're the fire department. You need to look to us to be saved. And so all of this is very revealing. It's very helpful because it's manipulative. What you're doing is you're peeling back the curtain on a manipulative tactic. And once people realize that that's the game, then they get a little more clear-eyed. It's not so mysterious. It's not something strange, and they're not confused. It adds a lot of clarity. So this is very helpful. And one of the things that we at the Christian Emergency Alliance strive to do is we strive to strengthen the church. And we try to do that where the church is under attack, where it's vulnerable, where it's weaker than it should be. That has global implications. That could play out in our own local fellowships. But I appreciate how in your book, you use the same metaphor of a body being strengthened, and how does a body protect itself? And one of the things you mentioned is, and you've already, I think, touched on it a little bit, but you talk about how the head essentially serves as a body's immune system, and that if it goes off the rails, other things go off the rail, and the entire body can become sick. Can you speak to that a little more?
Yeah, so that's a Friedman image that I always thought was really helpful, is that leaders function as the immune system for the bodies that they serve. And yet you need to think of an immune system probably more robustly than we tend to, because immune systems are, you know, we think of them as mainly the defense mechanism. So here comes an infection and my white blood cells kick into gear and to deal with it. But even before that moment, the immune system is a part of the regulatory system of the body that's sort of ordering and structuring the body for its purpose. It makes sure all the systems are sort of working in tandem and working properly. And so there's a positive role to that immune system. A healthy immune system is one where the body is doing what it ought to do and functioning well. And because of that, it's then able to fight off infection. On the other hand, if you have leaders who are not, who are compromised, who are abdicating, who are cowards, then oftentimes there's dysfunction in the body itself, which then makes it immunocompromised. Now, all of a sudden, infections find their way in every which way. And so recognizing that that's one of the fundamental things that leaders are, whether it's a home, whether it's a church, whether it's a missions agency, whether it's the state, whatever body you're talking about, the leader's responsibility is to put the body in order for the purpose that God designed it. So God has a purpose for your household. God has a purpose for your church. And he's put the leader in to sort of organize it for that purpose and empower the rest of the members of the body to do their role, to be the initiator, to lead by presence. You know, so you're active and present, and your presence is a certain kind of presence. You're there with that steady, stable, glad-hearted, faithful hopefulness. But then also your words and your actions sort of flow from your presence. And that's what helps sort of pull the body together to do what God designed it to do. And so having a vision of like, what's your main role as a head in your home? What's a dad? What's your role? Is it just to bark orders? Is it just to, you know, how does it work? And what part of the thing I'm commending is your presence, your steady, stable, glad-hearted, sober-minded presence is ground zero. That's what allows the rest of the body to kind of orbit properly. You're tethered to Christ. You're trusting in him. You're not fearing anything that's frightening. And because of that, then your wife and your kids don't. Or if you're a pastor, because you and your elder team are steady, stable, steadfast, and glad-hearted, then the rest of your congregation is reassured. The sheep can rest easy because the shepherds are there to guard the flock and to lead the flock.
Right. And to play that out, I think you can see both in a negative and a positive sense these chain reactions that become possible. So if confusion in the leadership in a local church starts to buckle, that can breed confusion in dads, and now this confusion is playing out in family structures and homes. And one of the things we just have to realize is that there's no plan B. There's no reinforcements coming. We can't just stand and watch and look around and wait for something else to fill that gap. It's on us. So we need to step into that responsibility and recognize it. It is on us. That is our responsibility. But we really can. I also think that the positive version of that is as more of dads, more pastors recognize this and really reflect on what is their presence in that role supposed to look like? What is that supposed to be? It can have the opposite effect too. It's not just a nefarious degrading effect. If we start to stand up, even perhaps if you have a lot of dads and families getting healthier in a church, that can have a positive effect on the leadership team, which has effects on other churches and other families. So that's why I'm hopeful that books like yours, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, conversations like this, I know it's playing out in different circles. I'm hopeful that this momentum can build in a positive direction for the church. And one of the things you describe in your work is well-differentiated leaders. What are they and why are they important?
Yeah, so well-differentiated leaders is the term that Friedman used, which is part of, so he defined a faithful leader as a well-differentiated person with a non-anxious presence. It just rolls right off the tongue. And my attempt to translate that into the biblical category is to say it's a sober-minded leader. And sober-mindedness, when you think about what does that mean? Well, sober, it's literally the opposite of drunkenness. That's where the word comes from. So someone who's drunk has imbibed alcohol or some other substance to the point where their judgment's impaired. They're not seeing things clearly. They're staggering. They're stumbling. They're not in control of themselves. Well, sober mind. So that's what sobriety would be, right? When somebody needs to sober up. But in as the Bible uses the term, it's not just about alcohol. You can be drunk on passions, on your desires. When your anger or your fear or your lust or whatever passion, pity, there's all sorts of passions that we have that in themselves are good, but they're meant to be governed. They're meant to be shepherded and stewarded under in obedience to God. Well, when passions are leading the show, they lead us astray. They deceive us. They cloud our judgment. So I define sober-mindedness as a clarity of mind. So you're awake, you're alert, you see clearly, you're not clouded by all of that emotional angst. There's a stability of soul. So you're anchored, you're grounded, there's ballast in your boat that comes, you know, if it's Christian sober-mindedness, it means it comes from trusting in God and the gospel. Jesus is that ballast in our boat. So we're stable. And then a readiness to act. So clarity of mind, stability of soul, readiness to act. We're not passive. We're not abdicating. We're not checking out, but we're leaning in, ready to take to see the opportunities that God gives us in order to be faithful. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of leader that is, it's the opposite. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, that there's the cascade effect when Peter, for example, is fearful and everybody follows him. Cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. So when someone sees one person say, no, we're going to stay faithful, and they have some backbone, they have some nerve, and they stand up and they're steady, that has an emboldening effect on those around them. And all of a sudden, there's a cascade effect the other way. So it really is a potent thing because it's forming the new nucleus of a, mm-hmm. of a healthier body, which can lead and can isn't as worried about preventing all crises, because you can't. You're not in control of that. You're not trying to manage or control every situation, because you're not God. Instead, you're going, God's going to send us trials. We're going to be faithful through them. There's no way out but through them. So we're going to first take responsibility for ourselves, and then take responsibility for the body that we have. And we're going to lead through this, trusting in God, not anxiously reacting to every passion of man, every doctrine. You know, no, we're not going to be tossed to and fro by all of those things, but we're going to lead steady through it.
And I don't want to beat the metaphor to death, but going back to the body and your description right now, is it's almost like we're refashioning the neural networks in our brains. We're relearning new muscle memory in how we respond to these circumstances and stand up into the roles that God has granted us. And amidst the angst and the instability, this gravitas, this stability of soul, this readiness to act, this balanced nature of being a leader in these different roles is critical. And it's particularly critical, again, we're in 2024, things seem to be clown world, up is down is up. One thing you describe the setting, the season, as being we're in a crisis of degree. And that has a little bit of a sterile sound to it, but can you unpack that a little bit to make it more clear to our audience?
Yeah, one of the other sort of, you know, sources, you've got the scriptures, you got Friedman, but Shakespeare, I've taught theology and literature for years, and Shakespeare is a genius when it comes to analyzing the human heart and the social order. And so crisis of degree is his term, a breakdown of degree. Degree means something like a principle of cultural order. Basically obedience to the fifth commandment, where you know, honor your parents, honor your fathers and mothers, honor authorities, and then the authorities faithfully lead those that are over them. So Shakespeare has these images that I unpack in the book about where a leader is kind of like a planet in a solar system, or the sun at the center of the solar system, and it's the sun that makes the other planets orbit properly by gravity. It's invisible at one level. We don't see gravity, but it's real and it has force. And so a crisis of degree is when leaders have abdicated, and so now all of the planets are just wandering and colliding with one another, which in social terms would be multiplying envy, rivalry, conflict, quarrelsomeness, all of those sort of social dysfunction, scapegoating, blame shifting, breakdown of authority, rising rivalry, envy, multiplying, blame shifting, scapegoating. That's what happens when you have a crisis of degree. And Shakespeare pinpoints it to the abdication of leaders. They fail to be to have gravity, and therefore the society breaks down. So that's what we're looking at when we're looking around us. And the antidote is that steady, sober-minded leaders who take responsibility. So that the biblical actually example that I use a number of them, but one of the most I think striking that kind of helps people see it is Aaron and the golden calf, where Moses is up on the mountain meeting with God. They've received the law, but Moses is now getting more details and getting the tabernacle plans and whatnot, and the people get agitated. And these are people who've been through the ringer, right? They were slaves. They were brought out of Egypt with 10 plagues. They were rescued at the last minute at the Red Sea. They were attacked. They didn't have food. Moses was the one who provided manna. He was the one who defeat, his arms are up and they defeat their enemies. They've leaned heavily on Moses as God's representative. And now he's gone and they don't know what happened to him. And so they go to Aaron and they say, "Hey, we're afraid. And we don't know what happened to Moses. We need gods. We need somebody who's going to take care of us." And Aaron abdicates. He acquiesces. Their agitation proves too much. And so he says, "Okay, fine, I'll do it. Give me your gold." And he fashions an idol and then tries to salvage it by saying, "This is the God who brought you out of Egypt, right? This is Yahweh. This is a feast of the Lord." And then when Moses comes down the mountain, so there you have abdication. He listens to the people. You have idolatry. They worship the golden calf. And then when they come down the mountain and Moses confronts him, Aaron says, "Well, the people, the people, you know how they are. They're, it's the people's fault." He blames the people. And this is sort of the pattern of that's the kind of abdicating leadership that leads to a crisis of degree. The people are now going to fall apart. They've broke out, the Bible says, to the derision of their enemies. They're just a big chaotic mess. Why? Because Aaron did not have the fortitude and the nerve to say, when they said, "We need gods," to say, "God is your God. Your God brought you out of the land of Egypt. He will protect you, whether Moses is here or not. God is your God. Trust him." He didn't have the nerve to stand up to the agitation of the crowd and instead allowed them to steer him.
Yeah, he essentially passed the buck. He abdicated his responsibility. He pointed to everybody else but himself. That is a great cautionary tale. I know we have to wrap up, but I'll just point this out. I sense that we are emerging into an era of smaller ministries, smaller churches, individual Christians shouldering outsized loads to advance the kingdom, to advance the gospel. There's new things being created, new entities being created, new leaders standing up when perhaps they weren't even thinking about it, but they just see the crisis of degree in the society, and they're just starting to build. There's this real grassroots, I sense, initiative here and globally playing out. So I'm hopeful that those leaders are paying attention to these types of lessons. And as we wrap up, I would invite any other commentary you have on that idea. But I would also appreciate if you could tell our listeners how they can go ahead and get a hold of your book.
Yeah, so if you want the book, emotionalsabotage.com, you can get it direct from the publisher that way. And so that's the simplest. You can get it on Amazon as well if you want to go find it there, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage. I do think that we're, I actually think we're going to have an era where there's going to be a kind of bifurcation. I think you're going to have really, really large churches, probably in particular locations that basically are functioning as alternative societies. As the wider society breaks down, and you have all of the crazy, and like you mentioned, clown world, and you've got all the sexual insanity and everything else, large churches will function as like mini societies where Christian families can raise their kids and conduct business and be faithful without having to lie about basic reality. So I think you'll have some, I think you will have some large mega, almost, you know, mega churches. And then I think you're right. At the other end, you'll have a lot of smaller faithful, where you have a real fit community with, that really takes care of each other. I think that the churches that will struggle the most are those mid-sized churches, mm-hmm. because they won't be big enough to function as an alternative society. They're going to have to be synced up more with the world. And therefore there's more permeable, more opportunity for worldliness to creep in. And therefore they'll have a harder time, because of the scale. So I think you'll see kind of a movement in two directions, lots of smaller churches with a few big mega cathedral type churches. Mm-hmm. That's a guess. In both cases though, the size thing won't actually matter as much as the faithfulness of the leaders who are able to anchor themselves in the truth, recognize the way that the world is going to try to steer them, and check themselves. Are you living before the face of God? Are you seeking to please him fundamentally, not your audience, not your target audience if it's evangelism, or your target audience if it's your church? But I'm going to please God. Let him calibrate my standards by him. And if I'm being faithful to him, I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. I'm not going to be steered in order to achieve a certain result or maintain a certain image. Right. I think that those kind of leaders, there's a way, maybe here's one way to put it. I think in the last 20 plus years, I think the value of credibility was kind of the main currency that church leaders wanted to have. They wanted a seat at the table. They wanted to be credible to the audience. And so credibility became really the main currency. That meant that they were, the temptation was going to be to get steered by your reputation. I think now, as we enter this more hostile environment, courage is going to be the fundamental leadership virtue. It's the leaders who are able to resist the mob, the reactive passions of their own people, of their own hearts, and of the world around them. Those kind of leaders will be incredibly attractive to Christians who are looking for any place to be faithful and to testify to the gospel. And it's not just hunker down. That's potent. You know, I think that there really is something. Courage is a really attractive thing to everybody. And so to see courageous leaders stand up, not buckle, to be joyful, glad-hearted, and rejoice even when the persecution comes, will be incredibly attractive both to Christians and, God willing, to the world.
Amen. And that was very well said. I couldn't say it any better, so I won't even attempt to. That was a great note for us to end on. Joe, thank you very much for your time. And to our audience, go out and check out this book. I think you'll be blessed by it.
Thank you for joining us today for the Christian Emergency Podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. Also, tell your friends about us and ask them to subscribe as well. To learn more about the Christian Emergency Alliance or financially invest in our ministry, visit us at www.christianemergency.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you again for listening, and stand strong out there.